The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Okay, so it's Christmas here in the Lane house. We've just watched the Star Wars holiday special. Emma is here.
Should
my daughter.
Say something?
Yeah, say something.
Something.
Yeah, nice. Her boyfriend Noah is here.
I'm here as well.
My son Noah is here. My son Ben is here.
Hi.
And my son Simon is here. Simon.
I don't want to talk.
Okay. And we're really just recording this in order to slap it on the beginning of a conversation with Harvey Kay, who is the author of Four Freedoms and Are We Good Citizens? And he is an historian. This podcast is one in which we discuss the British Marxist historians. And I'm glad to be releasing this interview with Harvey Kay on Christmas, because on Thanksgiving I released a previous interview with Harvey Kay. Harvey is a very wise and lovable, and he deserves to be on all of the holiday editions.
Instead of listening to this podcast, they should watch the Star Wars holiday special.
Okay, yeah. You shouldn't be listening to this right now. You should go to YouTube and look up the Star Wars holiday special. It is available there. But Merry Christmas.
Happy Moon, Life Day.
And Happy Life Day.
Happy Life Day.
Happy Life Day.
So we're going to talk about your chapter, Fanning the Spark of Hope in the Past, The Marxist Historians. That is a chapter from a book called Are We Good Citizens?
Yeah, it was a talk I gave. Actually, it was a talk I gave in 1999. It was an international conference that was being held every few years in Santiago, Spain. Not Chile, but Spain. And it was titled Debate on History. And the turnout was like 1,000 historians from all around the world. And I'm convinced they may well have asked Eric Hobsbawm if he could come and speak. It was a keynote. The idea was there were 3 days, 3 keynotes, or 4 days, 4 keynotes. And my theory is that they invited Hobsbawm to give a keynote, and they had invited me to just speak at one of the sessions. And then all of a sudden it shifted, and they said, would I come and give a keynote about the British historians? So that's my theory, that Hobsbawm begged off, and that they asked me if I could do it, and I did. Here's the irony of it. The guy who organized it had himself been a member of the Spanish Communist Party once upon a time and had left. And he had been trained in Paris. That's where he got his PhD, under the Annales School of History, which was a great school of history, but not specifically a leftist school of history. The early founders were leftists, but it was not known as a leftist school of history. But he had been able, and this was 1999, he actually was able to get the province of, Santiago was a city, the province is not Catalonia, it was, I'm forgetting, I'm blanking, shame on me. Anyhow, but he got the provincial prime minister to underwrite these conferences. And the provincial prime minister once upon a time had been a Franquista, that is, a politician under Franco. So the irony continued that here you had this gathering of historians who were generally left. I mean, I don't think there was a conservative historian in the thousand, but not all were necessarily socialists or Marxists or anything like that. And it was really great. The other thing was that out of the event, one of my books had come out in Spanish. In fact, it was the British Marxist Historians had already been translated by and published by a Spanish university press. Because of that occasion, my next book, The Education of Desire, another book of mine, The Education of Desire, which was a second volume on the British Marxists and related figures, that was I was asked, would I be willing to let them translate that? And that was another Spanish. So it's just, it was just an incredible 10 days in Spain, 5 days at the conference. And I came away very heady and very excited. And, anyhow, and it was just great.
I'm going to ask you a newbie kind of question here at the start. A few months back, maybe even a year ago, I interviewed Marshall Poe, who was a former columnist at The Atlantic. He runs a New Books Network, which is a podcast network for nonfiction books, including critical theory books, which that's how we have a relationship before we published them. And he's an historian, and his book was called How to Read a History Book, The Hidden History of History. I interviewed him, and I read a good portion of his book, and his book is all about convincing the reader that what matters when it comes to history is the historical record, and that an historian's job is to consult and learn and be kind of a messenger of history through that historical record. So your job is not to interpret so much as to verify and to...
That's more of a chronicler maybe than a historian, but go ahead.
Yeah. So and when I asked him, so doesn't it matter like what your approach to history is, like whether or not you're a Freudian or a Marxist or what kind of interpretive apparatus you're using as you approach the record? He said, you know, people want to talk that way, but no, what matters is whether or not you're accurate. Whether or not you're like, it's more like a science than philosophy.
So I said, well, I'm going to write a story about somebody like me and what I did to write one of these books, and then what the parts of the book mean, because the different parts of the books mean different things.
I feel like I am that undergraduate who has to, I thought I knew what a history book was before, but now I'm not so sure. And so are there different schools of thought? There must be, of how to interpret that record and what the methodologies would be to accurately interpret that record. I mean, it seems like you'd have to really, to be a historian, you'd have to know several ancient languages.
Well, no, I mean, I see what you're driving at there. This, I think I do. And the fact of the matter is you can probably go and you can read thousands and thousands of pages that differentiate these different sorts of things. But the answer is no. It's one technique. You go and you look at the artifacts that are from this place called the past. You put everything in chronological order. You interpret the information in such a way that you can tell a story that's plausible given the parameters of human activity and also the context of the time, that is the culture of the time. That's it. That's what we all do. I mean, historians will, you know, academics love to differentiate themselves from so many some other people. So they're always taking turns. I don't know if you've ever heard of this stuff. Like there's when I was in graduate school, it's like the linguistic turn. I don't know
right.
And now there's the like, I don't know, some other turn. And these turns are always happening. But the fact of the matter is that the basic technique that's involved is the exact same one that astronomers use and evolutionary biologists use. And basically you just look at the evidence that's from this place called the past, this kind of fictional place we don't know anything about. And we, you know, we try to verify the provenance of the documents to make sure they're genuine. And then once we've done that, then we apply sort of standard analytic tools, you know, reason and experience and knowledge. And
mentioned that an historian who had invited you to a conference came from a particular school of history.
Right, the Annales School of History.
So how many schools of history are there? And is there a school of history that's like Marshall Poe? That is it like an empirical school?
Well, that's a really good question. I couldn't possibly tell you how many schools of history there are. Okay. But I do want to respond to his assertion. Okay. And one of the ways I want to respond to it is by saying that the difference between there's a chronicler and there are historians. And a chronicler is the one, and this may even introduce us to the idea of the historian too. A chronicler is the person who, let's go back to medieval times, was supposed to keep the record of events, right? But as I once told a second grade class, right, I mean, there one has to choose among events, and the way one chooses among events will probably be determined by the kinds of questions they bring to the past, right? Okay, so, you know, I'll use the trivial example of the second grade class, and I said to them, well, we all know you guys had lunch today, right? And probably you all brought different lunch bags and had different things to eat. Now, there are those people who would just be really interested in the fact that you're all bringing lunch bags to school. Like, why aren't you eating a school lunch prepared in school? Okay, one would wonder about the question of nutrition. One might wonder about the economics. One might wonder about the funding of school, you know, that kind of stuff. I said, but somebody else who really had an interest in the ways in which people live their daily lives might really be interested in what kinds of things are you guys eating? You know, so one brings questions to the past. Well, in a case of a chronicler, even the chronicler who deals with the most fundamental question of, well, what happened today or what happened yesterday? What's going to, you know, it really has to ask, well, what matters to write down? I mean, what's of significance at that moment? Now, let me put it this way. Let's assume for the moment that historians and chroniclers at any given time actually agreed on what mattered, which, by the way, would be a very hard thing to do since the chroniclers really were being paid by the king or the duke or whoever to make sure that that person was celebrated in their exploits, right? Okay, so let's suppose they at least agreed. Now, the historian, looking back to the chronicles, may well buy into it. But the historian might also say, especially if they're coming from a more critical perspective, let's say whether it's a Knoll or Marxist, we'll say a Marxist, might well ask, well, okay, here's a record of the exploits of this duke, right, and his vassals or whatever against some other duke's armies or whatever, right? But if you're a Marxist, you might say, and let me put this into context, one of those British Marxist historians who we'll probably be getting to speak about, named Rodney Hilton, who was a medievalist and very much a Marxist, When I got to know him, he took me on a little tour of the part of England he lived in, to the sort of south and west of Birmingham, England, where he taught or had taught. And I remember we went to this town of Warwick, I guess it was, to what was the main old medieval church on the high street. And we're inside, and this man walks over to us and says to us, can I give you a tour? Would you like to hear about the exploits of, I think it was a duke or whomever was buried there? He and his wife had these tombs that were in the church in the back chapel. And Rodney, and this was, I'll never forget this moment, because my own response would have been, no thanks, okay, right? But Rodney said, well, I'll tell you. This is exactly it, but I'll tell you. You might want to tell us about the exploits. I want to hear about how he exploited his peasants, okay? And what the peasants themselves were prepared to do about it. Now, okay, there's a different question than the question of, say, what the chroniclers offered. I mean, I could go on and on about all of these kinds of things. But there
right,
you go.
Okay. So what determines the school that you're in might have to do with your politics or your philosophical orientation in the world in the present?
Yeah, assuming you have some kind of academic freedom, of course, right?
Well, you know, in the United States, say, where I think we do have some, or in England.
Yes,
so,
right. At least in a good many universities, right.
So, and there are competing schools then of history.
Yeah.
How do they compete? Do they compete on the basis of their fundamental assumptions, or do they criticize each other based on the record and like how somebody in the other schools being inaccurate about the record? How do they generally go at each other?
There are a lot of variables. Well, let's take one of the variables, okay? There's always the priorities of the historical profession, the questions that historians are asking. But then there are the priorities that I don't want to reduce it to the question of, in quotes, the market. Let's think in terms of the issues of the day, right? And we don't want to reduce the past to answering the issues of the day. But a good historian would want the past to speak to the issues of the day, perhaps. So, for example, whether you were an Annales school historian or a Marxist, you would clearly be interested in material relationships and all the more, given the world in which we live today, seriously concerned about environmental questions and how it was that any given, say, mode of production, whether it was a feudal order or more likely this capitalist order of ours, has worked the environment, transformed it, okay, for better or worse. And the better or worse increasingly seems to us to be for the worse, right? Now, so, and I don't think there's any question that the Annalists, as they might well have come to be called, or the Marxists would disagree on the imperative of addressing the question of the environment. But in the case of the Marxists, would be all the more concerned about linking it specifically to the ways in which capitalist industry and capitalist activities, whether it had to do with, you know, home housing developments, industry, or road building, whatever. okay, and how environment, you know, climate change, how it's been affected by that. But it is the case. So they might agree on all that, but they might bring to it a certain, you know, sort of, again, different kinds of questions. But I think what's important here is that as history itself changes, the questions we ask about the past may well change. And also, it may well be the case that certain kinds of questions are answered about what were the questions that might have mattered in, say, the late 19th century, the mid-20th century. And we might say, well, that's resolved. No need to revisit that. But of course we revisit it. We revisit it in light of the challenges that we face today. Okay? So, again, I go back to the fellow you're referring to. I mean, historian accuracy is an imperative. Okay, one of the sort of fundamentals of history is that we don't lie, right? And also that we appreciate, this should be true for any intellectual, that we enable ourselves to recognize when we are wrong. Okay, and again, I mean, it's been a long time since I've thought of myself specifically as a Marxist historian, but clearly I've written all this stuff about it, and even today I have. I continue to see the world in terms of what I've drawn upon from some Marx and Gramsci and these historians. And so, I mean, when I look out at the world, I mean, who is going to deny in light of the last 40 years, the degree to which we have been involved, whether we've seen the struggles from below, you know, adequately pursued, the fact is we've lived in an age of class struggle. Again, not the class struggle that we often think of, where, you know, workers are rising and, you know, or, you know, that they're about to struggle. But nevertheless, if the corporate order in which we live has compelled and sort of recruited a whole generation of Republican politicians to constantly seek to empower them, to cut taxes on the wealthy, to do a whole, you know, to reduce environmental regulation, labor relations regulations that have developed over time, to take back the rights of workers. Is that not class struggle? Have we not seen the rich get richer? Is this not a class struggle that has been in many ways sort of maybe more successful than any other, because it's so been so successful in, if you like, disempowering working people who from, say, the 1930s right through into the 1970s had created remarkable institutions of labor, had been successful in working with liberals and others in creating social democratic kind of policies and programs. So even though the events, we all agreed on certain events that have happened, we now ask new questions. And indeed, the questions that Marxists in the past would have asked surely are a hell of a good set of resources to be asking today.
Who were the British Marxist historians that you were writing about?
There were in the original work titled "The British Marxist Historians." I speak of five historians in particular, and these historians are all part of a generation, a cohort. One is older than the others, but they really are part of a generation. There's Maurice Dobb, who was a political economist who spent his career mostly at Cambridge University, and in many ways set an agenda for Marxist historians by way of a book titled Studies in the Development of Capitalism, by posing the question of how it was that feudalism gives way to capitalism. Okay. And that set an agenda for many historians, not only in England, but globally.
No, can I jump in and ask a question about that? What was it in that moment when he was working that made that particular question seem vitally important?
Okay, so here's the Great Depression of the 1930s is fundamental, because the question on the minds of socialists was, how did capitalism emerge from feudalism? How might socialism come to emerge out of capitalism in the classical Marxist sense? You know, it's too easy to just reduce it to the dialectic, right? And there were competing theories. I mean, for a very long time, as a consequence of not just Marx, but Engels' interpretation of Marx, later Lenin's arguments about how class struggle can transcend capitalism, a whole vast array of European intellectuals, were posing the question, how is it that working class movements emerge and what kinds of things can they possibly pursue on their own? It's an ongoing debate. And the Great Depression of the 1930s really posed the question in an urgent way, how do you transform a political economic order? I think so. It emerges out of that in the 1930s.
And, yes, it does. And what did they learn?
So the thing is, in his case, he really was giving all the more emphasis not to specific economic developments or technological developments, but rather to questions of class struggle. And the historians who I then write about, so one chapter I devoted to Dobb because of the way in which he set an agenda. The other historians were Rodney Hilton, who was a medievalist, who really did address the medieval history anew by actually raising the question of class, by challenging the assumption that that class was specifically a capitalist experience, and that the medieval order had been characterized by what we would think of as orders, the classic breakdown being those who fight, those who pray, and those who labor, or the lords, the priests or bishops, and the peasants, right? And he went back and basically looked anew at, if you like, lord and peasant relationships, the degree to which those relationships and the struggles that emerged from them actually shaped and reshaped the medieval order and drove or did not drive historical developments, in his case, specifically in England. And there were other great medievalists, not all of whom pursued that kind of sort of like class struggle analysis, but the grander debate in medieval history was what it was for him, and it was important to sort of push it in the direction of asking questions about class and class struggle. So Rodney Hilton, great medievalist. And now I'm talking about historians who attended university in the mid to late 1930s, in the midst of this Great Depression in Britain. And they had basically, the ones that I spoke of, except in one case who I didn't write about in the book but later spoke of, they went to Oxford and Cambridge. They were not necessarily – they did not come from wealthy families necessarily. They would have been scholarship boys, as they were called, when it came to what we would think of as high school. And then they had been brilliant young sort of students in the teens and found themselves admitted or recruited to Oxford or to Cambridge. And one by one, as they went to Oxford and Cambridge, they took up the study of history. Not the study of economics, okay? Not the study of economics. And then and in many of their cases, some finished their degrees before the war, but others were in the midst of their degrees. Let's not forget that for Britain, the war began in 1939. Most of them went into the British Army and served in combat, in fact, in World War II in various places in Europe. Had already, by the way, in the 30s, joined the Communist Party as a way of, in their minds, addressing the Great Depression and the British concept, and in some ways not only contributing to working class struggles, but also as a way perhaps of grabbing hold of history and empowering those struggles with a consciousness of the role of class struggle in British history. So when they returned from the war, and let me just finish the group actually. So it's Hilton in the medieval, Christopher Hill, who worked on the 17th century and became really the greatest scholar of the 17th century of his time, and became eventually the master of Balliol College, one of the really great schools within Oxford University. Then you had Eric Hobsbawm, probably the most famous globally of all the historians. He worked on almost encyclopedic range of subjects, from labor history to the study of peasants. He actually wrote grand European histories as well as world histories. And then E.P. Thompson, who was, to my mind, the most significant of the group in terms of transforming, first of all, the study of social history, and also his influence in the writing of history in Britain, and all the more in some ways here in the United States because of the questions he asked about class struggle and the challenges he offered, as did they all, to the standard Marxist notions of base and superstructure, that somehow first you have a class in itself that becomes a class for itself. These folks literally challenge all of that. And Thompson's great work, one of many, but his greatest work was The Making of the English Working Class, that was published in the early to mid 1960s over in Britain and remains a classic, you might say. Now, so most of them fought in World War II in the British Army, after the war, they returned to British universities, either as postgraduate students or even to finish their undergraduate degrees. And at that time, they came together in what was called the Communist Party Historians Group, which was formed, I guess, in 1946, remained as a significant group in the late 40s into the early 1950s. And in that sense, they were involved in a debate, an ongoing debate about how history ought to be written, and indeed, of course, what future for the labor movement, what future for questions of class. I mean, it was a remarkable time for them. Many of them felt that this really did shape their work for in later times. The Communist Party Historians Group broke up in many ways. It survived, but the key figures, many of them left in 1956 in a protest against Stalinism and the invasion of Hungary. And, you know, when the Soviets and their East European satellite armies invaded Hungary to suppress the efforts of Hungary to assert itself as an independent socialist country. So they left. Not all left. Maurice Dobb, the economist, stayed in, and Eric Hobsbawm stayed in, but they were part of a group that really did dissent inside of the party, at least as long as they could. The others left. Now, let's come back to them. Let's come back.
Yeah. One thing you said that was really interesting was they went to Cambridge
and Oxford,
and they decided to become historians. They studied history, not economics. I mean, you made the point.
Yeah, not economics.
Not economics.
In fact.
So when was this, and why were they turning away from an economic understanding of capitalism even then as they got into university? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. Here's the thing. Okay. There were certain figures inside of in part because their original interests had been in history. I mean, I think, you know, all as boys, their interests were in history and literature. That was something they all shared. And when they went to what we would think of as their high school years, I'm not even sure the subject of economics was taught in British high schools or even in the prep schools or what would be called public schools. So I can't say that they actually were trained to think in terms of economics. What I can say is, given the collapse perhaps of the world economy at that time, British, decidedly even more so here in the United States, it may well be that the economics that was being taught offered absolutely no insights into the working of capitalism as far as they were concerned. I'm projecting into them, perhaps, okay? But because when Maurice Dobb was at Cambridge, and he knew the other economists who were prominent at the time, like Keynes, okay? The fact is that as a Marxist, he was a rather marginal figure in economics. But he was not a marginal figure in terms of economic history, even though he was an economist. And I think I can say that these fellows might well have been interested in economic history, and in that respect, to some extent, social history. Now, there were figures in the 1930s who were writing British history from a Marxist perspective, and there were labor historians already in the 1930s. Now, two of the people that I want to mention, let me just say that there was an important book published in the 1930s by a communist historian titled A People's History of England. Okay? And in this book, this was an effort to, on the one hand, stay within the Marxist school of thought by way of Karl Marx, especially the Communist Manifesto, but also a way of recovering or laying hold of developments in British history through the centuries that mainstream British historians had celebrated. So in some ways, this became a very popular book. I mean, I have so many stories to tell, but I won't get into it.
Okay. Right. Well, I want to come back to that. I mean, but I just want to ask, to what extent was the Communist Party influential on the thinking that they were doing in university?
Here's the thing. Okay, it's a good question. God, it's like that's why I wrote a whole book about it, not simply a little pamphlet. So let's take those who were in British university in the early to mid 1930s. So this included Rodney Hilton at Oxford. You had Victor Kiernan, who is not in my first book, but is part of the second book, The Education of Desire: Marxists and the Writing of History. So, and in case say of Victor Kiernan. So he arrives at Cambridge, and he is like many of his generation, he has this fascination for history. There were great teachers of history. They really were asking questions about where the hell is the world going? Where is England going? Okay, and having entered the Communist Party and then being a part of that milieu in the 1930s. By the way, we shouldn't forget other people that they encountered in the 1930s at Cambridge were the folks who went on to become the infamous or infamous spies who worked directly for the Soviet Union. And there was this very interesting sort of interchange and exchange among them. And Victor Kiernan knew those folks, that he was part of that group called the Apostles, which was this like skull and bones, say, at Yale. And so there is that, and the big debate, and many of them went to visit the Soviet Union. They thought maybe that would offer an alternative to the capitalist world, which involves so much poverty and destitution in England and also in the United States. Now, here's the thing. This is really crucial. The Spanish Civil War, 1936, okay, where, you know, the first effort of fascism to turn back the advance of democracy under, you know, which is Franco versus the Republic, the Spanish Republic. There were, among their number, there were those who went off to Spain to fight in the international brigades. And say Victor Kiernan, for example, he was intimate. I mean, he was a dear, very close friend of some of those men who went to fight, two of whom were among the first killed in the Spanish Brits to be killed in the Spanish Civil War. So to them, the world history, history wasn't just what they studied. History was something that they believed they were a part of. They were going to be involved in the making of history. And to them, knowing what history entailed and the struggles that had gone into the making, say, of even of the most essential kinds of things, like getting the vote in England, the Chartist movement of the 1830s and 1840s. These things to them mattered. And there was a woman who was a communist journalist named Donna Torr, an older woman who in many ways was, you know, who later became in the Communist Party Historians Group, kind of like a godmother to all of them. And what she said to them is that, what we need to write a history that enables people to understand that history is made by those who worked and not only by those who lived off of the labors and of those who worked. And so to them, this was a deep and meaningful pursuit. It was not merely a scholarly pursuit. It was also decidedly a political pursuit. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. It helps a lot. And yeah. So if you compare,
I'll just note, in the 1960s, when I was just in high school and then moving into university, for a lot of us, whatever the politics that we might have possessed, a kind of radical politics, some socialist politics, a new left politics, the idea of history was something that it mattered to us deeply to lay hold of American history and remind people of the struggles that had gone into the making of American history. So in essence, it was these historians who influenced us from afar, and in many ways we adapted their ideas and their thinking in our own pursuits.
Right. So my question is now kind of going to be an odd one, maybe, or seem like a non sequitur, but I want to bring up Francis Fukuyama.
Oh, well, that's a real jump. Okay. So now we're talking 1989, 90, where
right.
The end of history, yeah.
But I think you mentioned him and one of the chapters that you sent me, maybe not this one that we're talking about, but the other one, you mentioned Fukuyama?
I wrote quite a bit about that whole argument of Fukuyama, that we had reached the end of history, that liberal, democratic, capitalist, democratic life, and the downfall of the Soviet Union represented the end of history.
Right. Right. So the reason I want to bring it up is because I want to see if I can make a comparison between the kind of historian that Fukuyama is and the way he thinks about history.
Well, he was a philosopher, by the way.
Right, but he does do a it's making a claim about history in any case.
Yeah, it's a claim about it. Nobody, historians do not have sole proprietor. They don't have any kind of sole ownership of history.
Right. Well, that's right. I guess he's a philosopher, not a historian. This is important for me to
a historian, by the way, very much influenced by Hegel, okay, and also I may not be pronouncing it rightly. There was a fellow Kojève, K-O-J-E-V-E, who I'm not familiar with, but it was some kind of arguments of his that I believe were influential to Fukuyama.
Right, right. So what I want to know is, like, when someone like Fukuyama comes along and looks at history and makes a claim like that we've come to the end of it, in a sense, based on a Hegelian interpretation of what history is and the dialectical progression of thought and form through history. Mm. What kind of questions of the historical record would Fukuyama be asking to come to that kind of conclusion, as opposed to the kinds of questions that the British Marxists were asking?
Okay. Let's start from this really important point. So Fukuyama, who by the way was brilliant in his efforts. I mean, I really marveled at it. But a couple of things are important. First of all, he was deeply embedded in the neoconservative school of thought and politics, okay? To the point where his argument, which first appeared in the magazine, The National Interest, which was a mouthpiece of neoconservatism, it was a magazine founded by a man who you may have heard of, Irving Kristol, okay, who had been a Trotskyist back in the 30s and then became a kind of American liberal, and then in the 70s abandoned liberalism in favor of neoconservatism. So and the magazine was, as I said, The National Interest, which was underwritten by I don't need to go there right now, but it's underwritten by some very conservative interests. Now, and by the way, who was himself the father of Bill Kristol, just for the record, who was the creator of – he worked for Dan Quayle and then set up the magazine Weekly Standard. And our listeners will be interested knowing that this week the Weekly Standard announced it was going out of business at the end of this month. Okay?
Yes.
Okay, how sad. Right, exactly. So my only concern is I actually do have a friend, a neocon, who has written for them for years, and we became friends and had some very very good intellectual exchanges, and I just hope that he can find another job. Okay, so – okay, but having said that, so Fukuyama – and that's the thing. Fukuyama wrote this article for this magazine, and the folks who underwrote The National Interest decided this was a great polemical argument and might well be the crowning kind of argument about the end of the Soviet Union and what it meant for human history. And they invested, I don't think I'm exaggerating, I believe tens of thousands of dollars of getting that book translated as quickly as possible into languages so the book could be published around the world. They also then underwrote his effort to write the full-scale book, The End of History and the Last Man, or something like that. Okay? Yeah, and what this... This was an argument that since the Soviet Union had collapsed, it showed the utter emptiness of any kind of socialist vision, as if the Soviet Union represented the sort of the crowning achievement of any kind of socialist vision. Fuck that. But the point was, and so the argument, that was the argument he offered. And he said that basically life in the future could very well be boring. We'll all get our, you know, he might have used the term stereos back then. This is before the age of the internet and all of that. So he's writing about this, and he said the only challenge that may emerge, which is not a universal challenge, because he said liberal capitalism versus socialism was universal challenge versus universal challenge. The only alternative might well have been Islamic political forces. But that, he said, was not a universal challenge. That was a particularist challenge. And we might well have to fight it, but we wouldn't necessarily have to worry about it as a universal challenge to Western liberal democratic life. Okay? Okay. So now, what was your question?
My question was, what kinds of questions did Fukuyama ask of the historical record that would be different and have a bit different orientation than the British Marxists would have asked?
Oh, well, the British Marxists were not... The British Marxists were asking about how history is made. They rarely offered grand visions. I mean, that number one. Number two, they recognized a democratic, small d democratic dialectic in which working people themselves were the challenge to the forces of what, you know, whether it was early or later capitalism, and to what extent working people themselves might actually be developing ideals and institutions and movements which would enable the transcendence of capitalism towards a more towards a more libertarian and democratic kind of political order and social order and economic order. Now, in Fukuyama's case, it's that kind of grand history, which, you know, like Hegel believed the termination of history would emerge when the Prussian bureaucracy would become the sort of ruling class of Germany, right? I mean, I think that was the argument. So in this case, it was that sort of, you know, capitalism and the corporate order and the liberal values that, which, by the way, one could seriously question that capitalism and the corporate order, even with the struggles that working people had advanced to make it a liberal democratic society, that somehow that represented the end of history. So in his mind, it was a polemical argument. I mean, my God, it was as polemical and wonderful in its own sort of magnificence as one could offer. And, you know, I mean, I have to tell you that I was, a lot of us were just plain outraged at the capacity of the powerful and the wealthy to underwrite this argument and make it the prevailing public discourse.
Right.
Talked
about now.
Right. It became, in its own fashion, maybe because now, I mean, let's face it. I mean, whether or not DSA or any other kind of socialist, small s socialist politics is part of the prevailing discourse, we've come to see that capitalism itself may not be the end of history, that we have alternative visions. And by the way, this is what British Marxist historians were about, that one of the reasons you look at history wasn't just to see the sort of dynamics of history in any kind of grand Hegelian fashion, or for that matter, even Marxist fashion. It was also the idea that you studied history in order to see to what extent the struggles past and present offered movements, ideas, values that could be cultivated. And that would take us into a discussion perhaps of Gramsci, which actually might well be the basis for another
evening. Should do a podcast just on him. I mean, I'm not prepared but we should do a podcast on him. But let me just...
And by the way, let me just say, Doug, so everyone understands, this is work I did 35 years ago. So it's a remarkable thing for me to be thinking back to that kind of work. And I actually spent the day, I don't think there's anything wrong with telling listeners, I spent the day rereading my own books. And one of the things I thought is, God, I was pretty analytical once upon a time. I mean, I really could not believe the kinds of things I was capable of doing. Whereas today I have I think I'm closer in many ways to the historians themselves than I was, you know, really eager to show the degree to which there was a kind of small d, small m democratic Marxism worth advancing.
Right. So here's what I want to ask. This is why I brought up Fukuyama, and this is what I'm trying to figure out. And I have suspicion about it, but I don't really know. But one of the things that's most interesting about Fukuyama and the people who underwrote his books and made him a world famous philosopher is that they themselves, that whole conservative movement, have some strange connection to Marxism, because the neoconservatives themselves were all, for the most part, ex-Marxists.
Well, that's a good point. If you think about there was a generation that became the neoconservatives. Irving Kristol is the primary candidate to represent them. And this goes back to the 1930s at City College, New York, among other places, where these young where the British Marxists over in Britain were throwing themselves into history, these young sort of Trotskyists and Stalinists at City College, I don't know if they were studying history or philosophy, I don't know enough about them to be honest, but they came through that period learning how to argue, learning how to go after their opponents. And so you had the communists debating the Trotskyists, you had the social democrats and socialists of the day. I mean, you can imagine what these 19 and 20 year olds were arguing. And I mean, it's a phenomenal kind of time, but keep this in mind. This is important that they later, I mean, Nathan Glazier, I'm thinking about all the names that come to mind, but they themselves maybe held on to those memories of those grand debates. So when you get a figure like Fukuyama offering this grand historical argument, you can imagine the degree to which they must have salivated at the prospect of promoting that kind of argument. So they knew their Marx, they knew their Hegel, and here's Fukuyama offering a kind of, you know, Hegelian alternative. Let's think about the late 1980s for a moment. Let's think about the times, right? So this the 1980s is the era of Reagan here. Okay, it's the age of Reagan, but it's also the time in which Soviet Union is collapsing. But let's also remember this. This is important. 1989. It's the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution. Okay, it's also the time in which Chinese students and workers mobilized en masse in Beijing and elsewhere. What, 2 million turned out in Tiananmen Square to challenge the authoritarianism of the Chinese Communist Party and the state that they ran. This was and what did they do? They marched and they had images of Lady Liberty, who that echoed the French Revolution and even the Statue of Liberty in the United States, by the way. So there, even as the Soviet Union is collapsing, and by the way, you had, you know, I mean, all this was, I mean, it was an incredible time. And what you get is this possibility in 1989, right, of changing the world. And here's Fukuyama's argument to bolster the, you know, to bolster the confidence of the corporate classes. How does that work?
Clearly propaganda in a way, but on the other hand, it does come down to what kinds of questions you want to ask and also how you interpret things to a degree, because it could certainly,
by the way, by the way, Paris, you know, I mean, there was all
right,
that stuff.
Right. But I was going to say that when it comes to China, certainly the neoconservatives would be quick to point out just what you pointed out, which is that what the Chinese were asking for was liberal democracy, which, of course, they were great advocates for in their own estimation.
Hold on. This is really
in their own estimation.
Wait a second. You know. But these. OK, first of all, if you read the media of the day, you'd think this was a student movement. Right. But this was a student and workers movement. And the neocon in China. Absolutely. So you can. I mean, you think the neocons celebrated workers movements?
The degree to which it was politically useful. I mean, Reagan celebrated solidarity, right?
But they weren't calling for capitalism. That was the students and workers were not calling for capitalism. They were calling for a liberalization and a democratization of China. That's different.
Friedman would walk in at this point and say, "And when you want liberalization and democracy, you have to have capitalism."
Yeah, well, fuck him. Okay.
Let's be clear. I don't believe in democracy in one sense. You don't believe in democracy. Nobody believes in democracy. You will find it hard to find anybody who will say that if democracy interpreted as majority rule. You will find it hard to find anybody who will say that if 55% of the people believe the other 45% of the people should be shot, that's an appropriate exercise of democracy. What I believe is not in democracy, but in individual freedom, in a society in which individuals cooperate with one another and in which there's an absence of coercion and violence. Now, it turns out that democracy, in the sense of majority voting, is an effective means for achieving agreement on some things, on things which are not very important, really important things. We require much more than a simple majority. We require something as close to unanimity as we can get. That's why we have a constitution as well as legislative law.
And look, and by the way, but wait, no, hold on. There were other books that were coming out of the time, Peter Berger and others, who were talking about the imperative of capitalism. And look, the fact is that these students and workers were not asking for capitalism. They were asking for liberalism and democracy. And by the way, whatever kind of order comes up in the future, I will not sacrifice the values and triumphs of liberalism. I will not do it. If we can't create some kind of democratic, and by the way, and I prefer the small d democratic vision over a lot of terms. If we can't hold on, and by the way, Marx himself would insist upon that. And if we can't do that, then hell, I don't know what, I don't know where I'm going.
I'm enjoying this, getting your ire up and not even intending to. But here's the thing that I want to to say about this is that what I'm trying to ask is, how is it that we have these neoconservatives who would end up embracing capitalism as if, and kind of siding with Milton Friedman, who would want to spin a moment like what happened in Tiananmen Square as Chinese workers and students struggling to become liberal bourgeois capitalist democracies? You know,
how could they do it?
But how could they come from Marx and do it? What kinds of questions were they asking originally? What was their movement like?
But they didn't come from Marx. They had already abandoned Marx. They thought they were experienced enough. I mean, don't forget, we made a giant leap of history.
Right, I know. But why did they abandon Marx?
Hold on, we left out the important things. So these neocons emerge as a force in the wake of the 1960s. When in fact, and this is something that has yet to be fully appreciated by even you, our fellow citizens. If you look at the 1960s, what do we think about? Because at the silliest level, simply sex, drugs, and rock and roll, period, right? We think about student protests. We think about struggles in the streets, whether they're students or in the wake of the civil rights, the sort of Black Power movement. We can go on and on and on, right? Anti-war and so on. But what we generally forget is the degree to which the 1960s, right into the 1970s, were marked by serious working people's movements. Okay, it wasn't like labor itself, you know, just hung out on the street corners. And, you know, we all fell into this trap of believing every worker somehow donned a hard hat to beat the shit out of some student on Wall Street. There were divisions. I'm not talking about some grand unity. The fear was on the part of the neocons and others that, in fact, young working people and young student movements might well merge together. Let's not forget that there might be Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, but the fact is that state universities across the country were filled with the children of working people. And those students were also against the war. And by the way, the majority of working people were against the war, but having been thrust into it, they did not want to abandon their own kids who were in the military. And in the 1960s, public employees were mobilizing. I mean, this is really important. This is the age in which public employees are mobilizing and creating labor unions. And this goes on into the 70s. And there were more strikes in the 1960s than there were for quite some time since, say, the 1930s or 40s. I mean, it was a dynamic time. And the neocons – look, I'm going to bring up the thing that immediately – I think we may have talked of on another occasion. The Trilateral Commission that was formed among the sort of corporate elite – and political elite of liberals, some liberal Democrats and conservative and moderately conservative Republicans. It included the likes of George Bush and Jimmy Carter. Okay, when they created the Trilateral Commission and they issued that report, the 1975 report on the crisis of democracy, they laid out the list of folks who needed to be constrained and contained, and it included students, minority movements, the expectations of women, and workers, especially public sector workers. I mean, these folks, the neocons, as well as conservatives generally, they were responding not to their own ambitions in some Hegelian fashion. They were responding to the struggles from below that had characterized the 60s and continued to persist into the early 70s. And they truly did fear the possibility of some kind of grand left liberal kind of coalition that was at least sort of indicated maybe in the McGovern movement, though, you know, the McGovern 72 campaign, but obviously collapsed before it became, you know, anything significant. So let's not forget, and this is the point, by the way, there's so many things we jumped over. This is one of the things that I learned from the British historians to understand the degree to which movements and ideas emerge in the course of struggle.
Right. Well, what I was going to ask you is, I mean, if you look at someone like like Irving Kristol, and how he came out of the originally came out of the Trotskyist anti-Soviet tradition, say, in New York, and how he became a neoconservative. And I guess this was in the 60s. It was right around the time that you're talking about.
He had already abandoned Marxism sometime before.
Right. So when did he – so like – what?
After World War II and the Cold War, he had moved into the ranks of liberals. And In fact, and his wife, by the way, was also a remarkable woman, Gertrude Himmelfarb, a very, very well-known historian, actually of Britain. And I have to tell you, it's kind of funny. The first major review in this country of the British Marxist historians was in the New Republic by Gertrude Himmelfarb. Okay, the neocon, who, by the way, was the mother, I guess, of Bill Kristol, unless I've got my names wrong there.
So what was it that moved him out of the Trotskyist tradition? And why would the British Marxists
I think World War II,
take a different path?
I think World War II and the Cold War here in the United States. And the British Marxists came back. Well, I think the British Marxists came back from the war. And in Britain, the labor movement had succeeded in taking hold. In 1945, labor was elected to power in Britain, and thus began a kind of social democratic era in British life. The nationalization of the railways, the creation of national health care, and the British Marxists saw themselves as being on the left, you might say, of this social democratic politics of the day. So there you go.
Okay, so that's the answer. So the difference there between these people who end up with Fukuyama and the kind of Marxists that you aligned yourself with is really the history of the labor struggle and its success or failure in Britain as opposed to the United States.
At least the capacity of labor to take power through the Labor Party in 1945, right? Whereas in this country, what happened in this country is another story. So Roosevelt dies in 1945. Harry Truman succeeds him as the president. The labor movement is prepared to create a social democratic America. In 1944, they laid out a remarkable agenda that had been, if you like, projected by Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt called for a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights in 1944 in the State of the Union address. Now, he knew that the capacity of doing it, of literally enacting it, was extremely limited because, look, I mean, we could perhaps reduce it to race in this country. The Southern white Democrats were white supremacists. They might well have been, if indeed the United States had been an all-white nation, it was not out of the question that Southern Democratic leaders might well have embraced the Second Bill of Rights, except what their fear was is that that would include blacks, and they had little interest in empowering labor. Got it? So, but liberal Democrats north and west, I mean, they were more committed, you might say, to the labor movement. We got to do that at another time, I think, because I'd have to tell the whole story of the Four Freedoms over. Okay.
Right. No, I'm just I hope that you don't feel like we've been jumping around too much here.
Well, my fear is that we were starting to go in a direction that I really would have needed at least the hour to do it.
Right. We should do it again then. My question here is, when it comes to understanding history, how significant is it to determine where you start from?
Here's something to answer you. The British historians gained a foothold after the war in British universities that Marx which, by the way, this is everyone always asks, what happened in British universities? Wasn't there some kind of McCarthyism? And I can tell you stories about that. If you were already in a British university, and as some of them were, then in fact they were secured. They were not driven out. Okay. But if a Marxist historian of that group had sought entry to a university job, that was another thing. There was an antipathy to allow them into the British universities. So some, like Rodney Hilton, Christopher Hill, Eric Hobsbawm, they were in the British universities. Okay, E.P. Thompson had not actually wanted perhaps to pursue an academic job, but this is an important thing. After World War II, there was in Britain British universities were very elite institutions. They didn't have the kind of higher education system we had. So those who had an inclination to teach adults often ended up, especially if you were a member of the Labor Party, if you were a Labor Party intellectual or even a Communist Party intellectual, you might have ended up in the Workers' Education Association teaching adult workers at night, or you were in some kind of similar kind of program that the Communists might have been involved in. So their entry into adult education was by way of, indeed, capital A, capital E, adult education. And that's and then later they find themselves getting university jobs as the Cold War, you know, attitudes sort of declined. I mean, it's a very interesting story. Whereas in this country, Marxist historians in some cases were just literally driven out, as well as Marxist teachers in the schools. That's a different it's a different Cold War history. And to whatever extent the Labor Party despised the Communist Party, the fact is that the Labor Party's power in the late 40s surely at least assured the survival of Marxist historians in British universities. Another a good example it would be George Rude, who was one of the key figures in the British Marxist historians' generation and tradition, who I dealt with, who I address in the second book, The Education of Desire. George Rude had served in the fire. He served in the what you would call the fire service during World War II. He didn't go into the British Army, so he was in London. He was older than many of them, in London, serving in the fire service while pursuing his PhD at the University of London. And after the war, having won, by the way, he won one of the major prizes, in fact, the key prize for his dissertation in the 1940s, which had to do with a British history dissertation. I'm forgetting the title right now. But he could not get a job in a British university. So he ended up teaching it in a high school during the 1940s, and then lost a job because he was seen sort of, you know, doing corner, you know, sort of doing public speaking on behalf of a kind of the Communist Party. Then he lost his job. Then his job, he was constantly moving about, and only finally secured a British university job when he was offered a position in Australia.
So the degree to which you face oppression and your political options are limited, both, and your career options are limited, that's the degree to which you might be pushed to the right. Would you say that's...
Well, they weren't.
In the United States, it was even worse.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent any of those neocons ever faced career questions so much as they came back and just had this antipathy to talk. Here's another thing, that a lot of the neocons who had been at City College were, in fact, Jewish. And they came back from the war with good questions about the dangers of the term they used, totalitarianism. And anyone who would, I mean, the Soviet Union was just that, totalitarianism. And I remember asking these historians when I did the work on them why it was they hadn't left the Communist Party when the Hitler-Stalin Pact was signed. And their answers were, they fumbled on their answers. They had no really good answers. Like that I will tell you. Okay. A lot of people left the Communist Party both in this country and in Britain at that time, and they fumbled. That's all I can tell you. And
so this is one of the questions I had written down I want to ask. To what extent were the British Marxists aligned with, say, Trotsky or aligned with...
Oh, they were decidedly not Trotsky. They remained in the Communist Party. Let me make it clear. They were not specifically Stalinists. They were what they did as the Communist Party historians group was allowed a lot of freedom and leeway. I wouldn't use the word Stalinist to apply. Let me put it that way. I think the shame of it is that they couldn't find their way out of the Communist Party. But they were not Stalinists. And in fact, the histories that they were writing, even in the late 40s, though it was clearly a sort of, if you like, an echo of an earlier kind of Marxist history, they had really were already breaking with that. They were already asking new questions. However, let me be clear. The degree to which they didn't break with the party, they found that the party just didn't basically tell them what to do in terms of the questions they were asking. Eventually, they realized the imperative of leaving, and they probably should have left earlier. They left in 56. I'm neither going to excuse what they did, nor am I going to say that they did. I'm just not going to do it.
When I said that they were Stalinists, I didn't mean that they were reading Stalin or agreeing with everything that Stalin wrote or you know, thought of themselves as ideologically Stalinist.
Right. In the 30s, they made their political allegiance clear. They joined and stayed in the Communist Party. Right.
You know, you could break with the Communist Party and still remain a Marxist by becoming some sort of Trotsky.
Yeah, well, Trotsky is their own party line. I mean, keep in mind, these are competing party lines.
Right, but okay. These are competing political projects around Marx.
Right, yeah,
right?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
So they were aligned with the political project that was still very – that was tied to the Soviet Union and believed in the Soviet project, even if they had – were dissidents within the party and had a lot of autonomy within the party and didn't have to stick.
Yeah, right.
So when you're talking about the difference between the British Marxists and the people who became neoconservatives, one of the differences that may not be decisive but is there is when they at what point they broke with the Soviets.
Yeah, I don't – you know, honestly, I don't know enough about the neocons and their immediate efforts after – you know what? Here's the thing about the neocons that I can tell you. So the generation that we're generally referring to as neocons didn't immediately become neocons. They actually became very significant liberal historians and social scientists – not historians, sorry, social scientists, some historians in fact. Now, there were those who became – keep in mind, don't forget, McCarthyism for some meant that they turned on their former, you know, party members. So Daniel Boorstin, who became a major – public historian in this country and eventually librarian of Congress. He had been in the Communist Party, but he ran so far from the party that he is amazing. He named names is my recollection, as they say. And not only that, he actually wrote a book, The Genius of American Politics, which was such a travesty of historical thinking, in which he basically makes the argument that it's Burke who is the major influence on American Revolution, which was utterly fucking ridiculous. Okay. So, yeah.
So what was his most famous book, Daniel Boorstin?
Oh, geez. You're asking me a question I can't recall. I didn't train in American history. I trained in Latin American history and then did the British stuff. And when I look back at all this, the one work that I read of his was The Genius of American Politics. It may well be that the book that was famous, he may have written a book called The Americans, like a two volume kind of piece of shit.
Well, the book that I'm thinking of that I think I've read by him is called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo Events, which I read while I was in college. Yeah, and it was popular in the late 90s because it tied into it's like it was popular in media and communications departments because it kind of echoed or was a proto postmodern work that, you know, if you liked Baudrillard, you might like Boorstin's the Image.
And by the way, some of these other figures probably. Well, let's put it this way. You had figures who were socialists, right, in the 30s, who found their way into the Americans for Democratic Action, you know, the Americans for Democratic Action. So they became, you know, militant liberals. I mean, that's what it was during the Cold War. They became militant liberals. And
right. They were the anti-communist left.
Yeah. Reinhold Niebuhr and others and Schlesinger and others.
And there's a lot to admire about some of those.
They were brilliant intellectuals, and they asked really critical questions. I mean, you know, the Cold War was a tragedy that needed to be addressed. And you know, that's again a story for another time. And I'm not, and even I don't want to even talk about the history because I'm not a specialist on it. So I'd be skating too much.
I didn't mean to end up in this position where I'm trying to indict the British Marxists by any means. I was just trying to.
Oh, sorry. No, I didn't sense that.
What I was really curious about.
I just wouldn't call them Stalin.
Right. And they're not. But what I was really curious about was how they conceived of history through a kind of class struggle that was worked out from the bottom up. As opposed to looking at these large kind of conceptual historical forces that you had to wrestle with.
Right. Well, in fact, what's interesting is to see their later trajectories. These historians, they never renounced Marx, but in some cases when I was interviewing them and getting to know them, they ceased to be as interested in the question of, like, the classic question of the transition from feudalism to capitalism, which, by the way, shaped my own dissertation for my PhD regarding Latin American development of capitalism. But they basically look back, like E.P. Thompson said to me one time, you know, I'm a post-Marxist. But in his case especially, what really led him to that had to do with the fact of the nuclear weapons. Now, in other words, Thompson above all, and they all were concerned about these questions, but Thompson above all really did fear what would truly be the end of history, and that was nuclear war. And he got deeply involved with the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in the 50s, and then was the co-founder of this massive European movement called the European Nuclear Disarmament Movement in the 1980s. This was huge. And by the way, he was probably the second best known figure in Britain in the 1980s after the Queen because of that movement. Fighting off, you know, the Reaganites who wanted to arm every European ally with Pershing missiles and everybody else. And Thompson had to face the question of whether or not the struggles of Eastern Europe to try to overthrow Soviet power that began with dissident intellectuals, to what extent he was willing. I mean, he was deeply involved with them, but his biggest fear was nuclear weapons and how to create some kind of trans-European nuclear disarmament movement. That really, he wrote a lot about it. He gave speeches. I mean, that mattered to him most. That he really did fear the end of history. Just as today we should worry about that by way of the sort of climate change kind of stuff.
While he was working on disarmament, there were Marxists. There was one, a guy named Posadas, who was planning for how communism would be born out of the ashes of a nuclear war, and slowly going insane.
That's very sweet, but I think the post-apocalyptic movies were probably closer to the reality of what we would confront.
Oh yeah, well his vision, in order for this to work, you had to throw in extraterrestrials.
By the way, let me just tell you, you brought up a very good thing. Thompson himself was a poet. He was a student of literature. He wrote the first great biography of William Morris. Okay, the author of News from Nowhere, amongst and all of that. But the other thing was, he actually decided one way to go about addressing this nightmare that he was having was to write a novel, and he wrote. It's called the Psychaos Papers, something like that. It was a great novel in which it's the arrival of an alien, okay, to on Earth that raises immense questions and the fears of the powers that be of what this alien might actually instigate on Earth, which is his way of going back to the old days of the arrival of an alien as offering social criticism, you know.
Like the Day the Earth Stood Still kind of book.
Yeah, you should read this. You know, it's been years since I read it because it's probably that many years since it appeared, because Thompson died young. He died at 69 years. He died in 1993. He was the youngest of the group that I just talked about, and he died, other than Dobb, who was that much older, but he died before any of the others. I will, and for what it's worth, just to leave it on a note, I had become close to a number of them. Once the book work was finished, in the course of writing it, I had greatly admired them, and afterwards became very, very close to a few of them. And Thompson was one of the people that I and a number of other people of my generation had gotten really very close to, and I just was shattered by his death. So,
how did he die? Just out of
he picked up some a disease of that affected his immune system, not specifically AIDS that any of us were aware of, but another his immune system was shattered, So, in fact, the book that I edited, a book, The American Radical, that came out in 1994 or 5 with Paul Buell and Mary Jo Buell. And he was supposed to write the foreword to that. He passed away. And then Eric Foner shifted from Thomas Paine to writing the foreword to that. And I wrote the Thomas Paine piece, which was the beginning of a whole new career for me writing about American radicals. So all these things are intimately connected.